Both of our speakers will take some questions now. And if you do have a question, should please come up to a mic here. Oh, hold on 1 second before the questions. Yeah.
Could I just say that now is the time to reach into your pocket and get your checkbook and to write a check to Code Pink, two words, Greater Boston, Code Pink, Greater Boston. This is to support the Gaza Freedom March activities. There's a huge need to make this march as strong and powerful as it can be. There is a need for all kinds of resources. Tens of thousands of T-shirts, for instance. Helium balloons. So at either end of Eretz, which is now a mile long, there will be a way of the two sides, the side that's marching from Israel to Eretz, the side that's marching from Rafah to Eretz, they'll be able to communicate. We're hoping to have video links set up so people on either end can talk to each other. We have to have a lot of really good media. All of this does cost money, including having people now in Egypt to do the negotiations with the Egyptian government so people can cross in to Gaza. So please, please, Code Pink - Greater Boston. So please do write your check and put it in a basket which will be passed round. And also now is the time to pass round the letter to John Kerry. And as soon as we get lots and lots of signatures, we're going to have a delegation go present it. If you want to be part of that delegation or if you want to do any other kind of lobbying, do sign up on the sheet, the general sheet, to get involved in Gaza Freedom March activities. Thanks very much. Are the letters going around? Yeah, there should be four different of these boards with the letters on it. Thanks a lot.
Any questions? Come up to this mic, please.
Okay, I have two questions. You can answer either or both of them, if possible. One is, there was a letter published about in February in the Financial Times saying that U.S. support was a geostrategic gift to China. U.S. support for Israel was a geostrategic gift to China. China, yes. It alienated the rest of the... It raised China's profile as... the letter was out of National University in Singapore. It was hotly debated in the Financial Times, but I never reached a conclusion. And the second question is, what is happening vis-a-vis the Turkish relationship with Israel? Turkey-Israel relationships. Thank you.
Well, the first question had to do with a letter that appeared in the Financial Times saying that U.S. policy with regard to Israel was a geostrategic gift to China. I do read the Financial Times, but I didn't notice any controversy over this. I mean, I can imagine what was in the writer's mind. I don't think it amounts to much. I mean, when the United States carries out any action that is bitterly opposed in most of the world, it's a kind of a gift to countries that are trying to displace U.S. influence. And that's true of U.S. support for Israeli crimes. It's true of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, of the invasion of Iraq, and in fact a whole host of activities. And this goes way back. There's nothing new about this. We don't like to look at our history, but we should. You can learn a lot from it. So everybody remembers, I'm sure, that George Bush plaintively asked, why do they hate us after 9/11? He said, it's because they hate our freedom. Almost nobody pointed out that President Eisenhower, had raised exactly the same question in 1958. This is internal discussion, long declassified. He asked, why is there a campaign of hatred against us among the people in the Arab world? He meant the Muslim world. And the National Security Council gave the answer. It said there's a perception in the Arab world that the United States supports brutal and oppressive regimes and blocks democracy and development, and we do this because we want control of their oil. And it went on to say this is perceptions more or less accurate, and that's about what we should be doing. So yes, there'll be a campaign of hatred among the people, and you know, maybe Russia in those days may get a few points from it, but it really doesn't matter much as long as we maintain our control. Well, that was when Israel wasn't even an issue. In fact, this was 2 years after Eisenhower had forced Israel out of Egypt, forced Israel, Britain and France out of Egypt, because they invaded at the wrong time and without asking the boss permission. So that you should have thought they would have had points for that. But it didn't matter. There was a perception that was accurate. Actually, after 9/11, the Wall Street Journal carried out a poll among selected Muslims, what they called, I think, moneyed Muslims. So like professionals, you know, heads of multinational corporations, Arabs, you know, people just right in the middle of the whole U.S. international economic system. They got about the same results. They said, yeah, there's a campaign of hatred because of the things you do. You block democracy and development. You support brutal dictators, so we don't like it. And by then they had other objections, like Israel supporting Israel's policies and bitterly opposing U.S. sanctions against Iraq. Again, we don't talk about that very much, but they were genocidal. Now, that's not my judgment. That was the judgment of the international diplomats, respected international diplomats who administered them, Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck, both of whom resigned in protest because they said the sanctions violate the Genocide Convention. Well, you know, in the Arab world, that mattered. So, yes, they had other grievances. And it continues. So let's take President Obama. He's very much praised for his speech in Cairo, you know, friendship to the Arab world, and spoke nicely and so on. But take a closer look. Take a look at what people say in Egypt saw. He was in Egypt. On his way to Egypt, he was asked what he's going to say about the Egyptian dictator, Mubarak, who's a brutal, harsh dictator. And Obama's answer was, well, I don't like to use labels for folks. No. As soon as a politician mentions the word folks, you start to shudder. You know what's coming next. So I don't like to use labels for folks. Mubarak is a man who's doing good and contributing to stability. Well, just think how that sounds to the people living under this brutal dictatorship. And then ask yourself why outside the West, nobody takes the United States seriously when they talk about Iranian human rights violations. How can you take it seriously if you have a gray cell functioning? So yeah, we continue the same policies. So sure, it'll help China make some contracts and Saudi Arabia, although, you know, I doubt if it has much of an effect because their concern for about human rights is about the same as ours. You know. The second question?
Turkey.
Yeah, the Turkish case is extremely interesting. I mean, Turkey has been, you know, a primary U.S. ally, and it's had has a pretty brutal history. So, for example, in the 1990s, Turkey was carrying out vicious repression in southeastern Turkey against the Kurdish population. I mean, they killed tens of thousands of people. They destroyed maybe 3,500 towns and villages, a couple of million refugees. They were doing it thanks to you and me. The arms were coming from the United States, from Clinton, increasing as atrocities increased. I mean, in a single year, 1997, Clinton sent more arms to Turkey right at the peak of the repression than in the entire post-Cold War period combined up to the onset of the counterinsurgency. Well, okay, that's pretty ugly. Turkey has been changing, and it's been moving towards a more independent policy. Just today, in fact, the Prime Minister announced that they're rejecting Obama's plea to send more troops to Afghanistan. They're telling the United States, look, we're not your lackey anymore. And they called off military exercises that included Israel that were kind of basically plans for bombing Iran. You know, they were overflights, over, you know, training exercises with NATO. They called them off. And they sharply attacked the attack on Gaza. and they're moving to a position of sort of standing between the East and the West. I mean, they've been trying for years to get into the European Union, and the European Union claims correctly that they don't meet European human rights standards, but as they come closer and closer to meeting those standards, the standards get higher and higher. And the Turks can understand very well that it's European racism that's keeping them out. Consider what happened in Switzerland a couple of days ago. I mean, suppose that Switzerland had passed a law banning the building of synagogues. Okay, I don't have to talk about it. But when it's the banning building of mosques, well, you know, a lot of not so nice, but not bad either, and so on. So they know that, yes, European Europeans don't want Turks walking around the streets. And as this is going on, and as they're kind of reconstructing their foreign policy in actually a more rational direction, they're moving towards closer integration with rather natural trading partners and allies in the Muslim world. That includes, in particular, Iran. Iran and Turkey are very natural trading partners. Turkey needs petroleum resources. Iran needs manufactured goods, and the same is happening with regard to Syria and others. So they're very close. They have had very close relations with Israel. They were Israel's closest ally outside the United States ever since 1958. Israel had military bases in eastern Turkey and very close military and other relations. But those are weakening as Turkey is simply taking a more independent stance in the region. I mean, this is part of the, it's still a unipolar world. You know, the United States still dominates overwhelmingly, but it's becoming a lot more diverse. And this is one part of it. Things happening in Latin America are another part of it. In fact, that's quite important. So, for example, people have been shouting for years about how awful it is that Chavez, you know, the main demon, has had friendly words for Iran. Look how terrible he is. Well, our fair-haired boy, Lula in Brazil, has had equally favorable words to say about Iran, but that's been kind of hushed up. It couldn't be kept quiet anymore. A couple of weeks ago when Ahmadinejad visited Brazil, so he was sort of admonished for not being a nice boy. But this is, it's continuing. The trading relations, other economic relations between commodity producers in South America and Iran and China are just growing very fast. The United States doesn't like it and is trying to stop it somehow, but it's not easy to control. The world is getting more diverse, and Turkey's an important case in point.
Thank you for your talk. I just have one question. And the question is, how do you see the role and the potential role of American Jewish congregations, synagogues and temples, in speaking truth and justice to power in Israel concerning the blockade of Gaza and the confiscation of Palestinian land in the West Bank?
Hmm. So the American Jewish community?
Yes.
There have been very notable changes. There are very scattered exceptions. Like the town of Newton happens to be off the continent. It's the one place which is totally berserk if you try to say the word Palestine. But outside of Newton, it's very hard to find a place that where you can't have meetings like this. I mean, and it's changed very notably in the past, even the past few years. I mean, not very many years ago, say 10 years ago, I mean, at MIT where I teach, meetings where, say, an Israeli dissident would speak or I would speak, had to have police protection. I mean, I had to have police protection to go back to the car, you know. If I was on campus somewhere, say, UCLA or something, giving philosophy lectures, and it's a real case, and one talk of the many I gave was on Palestine, the university police insisted on accompanying me every minute I was on campus, you know, in a philosophy seminar, for example. And it wasn't a joke, you know. They were picking up serious threats of probably the kind that the LA Church got, serious enough to be worried about. You know, they don't want people murdered on the campus and that sort of thing. But that's changed notably. In fact, by now, especially after, even before Gaza, but after Gaza, there was a dramatic change. I mean, it's now at the point where you talk to a general audience, a university or public, you really have to try to encourage people who defend Israeli practices, and you have to sympathize with them and encourage them to be willing to stand up and speak, because the atmosphere is intimidating. Everybody disagrees. Well, that's kind of like what was happening with South Africa in the early 60s. Took a little longer in the United States, but happened here too. And yes, that's developing, and the Jewish community is part of it. So if you look at polls, or even if you look at bloggers, there's been a significant change. There are things like, you know, J Street, the alternative lobby, which goes a little distance. There are other groups like Jewish Voices for Peace, Tzedek V'Shalom, others, which are springing up and getting a lot of support and saying, yes, we ought to protect human rights and international law, not just blindly support the state that we're supposed to worship. So let's depart from a kind of a Stalinist loyalty to the holy state and care for honest, decent principles. That's very notably changing. And it'll have an effect. They're worried about it in Israel, very concerned about it, and rightly. I mean, Israel itself is becoming kind of paranoid. I mean, if you read the Israeli press, you can see it. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, there was an article by, I think it was translated into English, by the editor of one of them, the economics reporter, Sever Plutzker, I think his name is, one of the main journals. He described how he was invited to give lectures at Oxford. And he was to talk about the economic, you know, the economy of Israel or something, his field. But he got a letter from a colleague of his, an Israeli colleague in Oxford, who told him not to come because he said he would find the atmosphere, he'd be treated like a leper, he said. The atmosphere will be so hostile and intimidating, he won't be able to deal with it. Well, that's a vast exaggeration. Actually, I was just in England a couple of weeks ago. It's nothing like that. But it's a paranoid reaction to something real. You know, and what's real is growing and developing, and it's familiar. That's what South Africa was like not long ago. Now, that's what the United States is like in a large part of the world. And they can take the position of the South African foreign minister and say, well, nothing matters as long as you back us. But that's a self-defeating position. That's a path to destruction.
Thank you.
Mr. Chomsky, good to see you again, sir. I have to go back to the Turkish question one more time, if you don't mind, because, as you know, about a year ago, Prime Minister Erdogan and Perez at Davos had this very loud argument, and it was the first time that I remember in that kind of a platform the issues being discussed was that dramatic. Now, of course, Prime Minister Erdogan did not do that because he thought it would be a good theatrical movement. It was actually because of the overwhelming public opinion in Turkey. And I thought that after I came to America, I noticed that that public opinion over here is very much manipulated, not so much in Turkey anymore, because people
That's becoming freer.
So in terms of manufacturing this particular consent that you always talk about, I feel that the PR industry here is a major block in people getting the information. And what do you think that can be done about that?
Yeah. Incidentally, do you have a background in Turkey?
I am Turkish, yes.
You're Turkish, yeah. Well, so you know the story better than I do. But look, I mean, I went to Turkey in 2002 to take part, actually to be a co-defendant. I insisted on being a co-defendant in a trial in a security courts of a publisher who was being tried because he had published a translation of a book of mine.
I haven't.
Yeah. The book had about 3 pages on Turkey, you know, telling what in fact was going on in southeastern Turkey. So he was brought to trial, and I went over, and his lawyer suggested I ask to be a co-defendant, and I did. And the security courts are a complete farce, you know. So there was a lot of public, you know, there were journalists, you know, television cameras, and they didn't want to embarrass themselves. So there was obviously a deal between the prosecutor and the judge to essentially call the court case off. incidentally, this is a little beside the point, but I saw right afterwards one of the most ugly performances on the part of the international press that I have ever seen. There was a lot of international press there, mostly European, but some American. And they watched all this, you know, went away happy. As we walked out, a young woman was being brought in, a Turkish journalist, and she was going to come up for trial, probably on some similar charge. Now, if those journalists had been willing to stay there for another 15 minutes, she would have gotten out. But they all left, and they all knew it, you know, because they all know the thing is a complete farce. But they left, and she's somewhere in some Turkish prison. However, I should, and I went to Diyarbakir, you know, southeastern Turkey, and I went back a couple months later and so on. But it was quite interesting to see these. Turkey is a very unusual country. I mean, I don't know of any other country in the world where leading figures, leading writers, you know, journalists, artists, academics, you know, publishers, and so on, not only harshly condemn the brutal practices of the regime, but are engaged in constant civil disobedience against them. I mean, nothing like that goes on in Europe. I mean, when I go to Europe and I hear people tell me the Turks aren't civilized enough to join the European Union, I have to collapse in ridicule. And they're way ahead of the European Union and the United States in this respect. And that continues. In fact, I've taken part in some of it and seen it. And it's changing. Now, when you talk about Turkish public opinion, that tells us a lot about ourselves. I'm sure you remember in 2003 when Donald Rumsfeld came out with this old Europe, new Europe distinction. And so everyone now talks about old Europe, the bad guys, and new Europe, the good guys. Take a look at what actually happened. Old Europe is a very striking indication of our concept of democracy, ours. There was a criterion distinguishing old Europe and new Europe, and Turkey's a crucial part of this. Old Europe were the countries where the governments went along with a large majority of the population and refused to support the invasion of Iraq, and Germany and France, you know, the bad guys. You had to stop eating French fries and so on. Who was New Europe? New Europe, the leaders of New Europe were Italy, Berlusconi, and Spain, Aznar. They opposed an even larger majority of the population and joined the United States. So they were the hope for democracy. In fact, Aznar, who was the most extreme, was invited to the summit where Bush and Blair declared war because he was such a representative of the triumph of democracy. He had 2% of the population supporting him at the time. So that's democracy. But Turkey was the most interesting. In Turkey, 95% of the population opposed participation in the war. And to everyone's surprise, mine too, I should say, the government went along with 95% of the population. I mean, they were bitterly condemned. Yeah. Paul Wolfowitz, who's supposed to be the big idealist, was sent to...
He flew into
Turkey to admonish the military because of their failure to overrule 95% of the population and force the government to go to war. And in fact, he told them straight out, he said, you know, you have to apologize to the United States and recognize that your task is to help the United States. Then you'll be democratic. Okay. And this passed here without a comment. That was reported here, but you know, not a flicker of an eyebrow. Yeah, that's our concept of democracy. Now, Turkey's light years ahead of us in this. And it's true that they're now continuing. And I must say, when I was there, even though I was, you know, bitterly attacking the government and so on, I was invited on television and, you know, interviewed in newspapers, and a lot of it was pretty friendly. In fact, on the plane back, it was Turkish Airlines, so everybody was Turkish. So I didn't understand a word anybody was saying, but my picture had been in the newspaper. And a lot of people came over and said, you know, thanks for saying these things, and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I must say I had a very favorable impression both times I was there of the population. The policies were awful. But now the policies are, I think, getting more in line with popular views, and there's a good deal of hope. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate. You know, there's plenty of jingoist nationalist feeling around, but I think it's declining.
Hello, Dr. Chomsky. Okay. Hi, sir. I have two questions for you. My first is, beyond going to protests and writing to our senators, do you specifically see what more we can do to try to change the situation in Palestine and influence U.S. policy? And my second is, much of what you said is we don't really read in the mainstream media. So I was just wondering, where do you get your news from?
What would I?
Pardon me? Where do you get your news from?
A lot of the news is right in the media, like what I just said about Turkey. It was all in the New York Times. They just didn't see anything wrong with it, you know. So, yeah, it's there, you know. And in fact, not everything, but a lot of things are there. Sometimes you have to go somewhere else. Like, for example, there's huge furor about Iran disregarding the International Atomic Energy Agency. Okay, you read that in the front page every day. That's probably true, concealing something. Well, I happened to be giving talks in Mexico a couple of weeks ago, and I read the Mexican press. And in the Mexican press, they reported what the wire services were reporting, what is on every desk of every editor in the United States, that the International Atomic Energy Agency, right in the middle of this furor, had passed a resolution calling on Israel to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty and to open up its facilities to inspection. The U.S. and the European Union tried to block the resolution. They couldn't. It was voted anyway. They voted against it. That's Europe, too. But it passed. But I then had a friend do a database check here. In the English language press worldwide, it was reported in the Irish Times. You know, so yeah, you sometimes have to go to, say, Mexico to find out what's going on. But you can get find out quite a lot. It's not that hard, particularly with the internet. If you know the right places to go, you know, you can't just roam the internet. But if you sort of have a framework of thinking to look for things, you can find out a lot. So say take the Financial Times. Business newspaper, world's best business newspaper, publishes a lot of things. So again, right in the midst of the furor about Iran, Iran disregarding the Security Council resolution calling on them to, you know, open up about what they're doing, right in the middle of this, India announced publicly, and you can read it on the front page of the Financial Times, I didn't see it here, announced that they are now able to produce nuclear weapons of the same yield as the United States. And they're building up their nuclear weapons programs with U.S. support. So they didn't conceal anything. They said it straight out. It was concealed here, but you know, if you read the Financial Times, you could find out. And it's a little work, you know, but there are enough hints in what appears here to even tell you what to look for. For example, in the old Europe, New Europe story, where the basic facts were reported here, they just were interpreted in a way which, you know, kind of makes you think you're living in Stalinist Russia. But that's the interpretation. The facts were there. What can we do? Quite a lot of things. I mean, Nancy mentioned a lot of things, but there's a lot more. I mean, take that Amnesty International report. We should be organizing a movement to get the American people to press the government to follow U.S. law. Now, that's not a very radical position. Yeah, how about following our own laws? Where Amnesty International, you know, not some far-out group, is saying you should follow your own laws and international law and stop sending arms to Israel. We can do that. You know? And there is a lot of talk, which in my view makes sense, about what's called BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Now, in itself, it's kind of a blunt instrument. It can be used well or badly. But it can be used well. And I think to use it well means to use it in a way which is going to affect policy. Okay. Now, the primary way to affect policy is to affect public opinion and actions here. That's the primary way. Otherwise, it's going to be like South Africa. You know, yours is the only vote that counts. But So even U.S. sanctions against South Africa were overridden by the Reagan administration. But targeted sanctions, which have been very successful. So, for example, in Europe, there's been a lot of success in boycotting and sanctioning corporations which are involved in developments in the West Bank. And that's been very successful, both educationally in getting Europeans to understand what the governments are doing and pressuring them to stop it, and also in changing Israeli policies. And we can do the same. Military corporations, corporations like Caterpillar, which are basically killers, and others, are very proper targets for BDS campaigns. And there are some good examples, like Hampshire College. If you look closely at their BDS program, I think it's kind of a model, which could be carried out elsewhere, and those things are effective. They do change opinion, they change business behavior, they ultimately change government behavior. There's only so long that a government can stand up against its population.
Hi. It seems to me like there is a, yes, for you, that there is some sort of debate that I have on the left with people where it's basically between whether or not Obama is sort of one of the old boys, or is he a genuine sort of Chicago guy who is trying to make a difference, but he's trapped within the establishment. And I was wondering if you, I mean, it seems to me that there are major gaps in his life that are unaccounted for, even though he's been all over the press. And do you have any insight as to whether or not he is one of the old boys, or is he...
Well, you know, I don't know any more than you do. I don't have any insight into him. Actually, there is a good study of Obama by a very smart analyst who's been following him most of his political life. It's Paul Street. Has a book on, I forget what it's called, but tracing his background in Chicago politics and so on. It's not very, not a lot of applause. But he's a smart guy. I think he's accurate. But, I mean, before the primaries even, I was writing about Obama's positions, particularly on the Middle East, just using his website. And there's nothing that's happened that's at all surprising as far as I can see. I mean, for example, he was very proud that he sponsored a resolution, a Senate resolution in 2006. I forget the exact wording. It was something like a resolution to make sure that the United States didn't impede in any way Israel's invasion of Lebanon to allow them to slaughter and destroy as much as they wanted. Okay, that was on his website before the primaries. And his undying love for Israel and so on was there too. And practically, I don't think if there was a word about the Palestinians, that's about it. So what's the surprise? And pretty much the same on other issues. I mean, if you look at his campaign, it was about what if some Martian who understood American politics predicted a campaign, he would have predicted Obama's campaign. I mean, his advisors and campaign managers read the polls, obviously. They can see that 80% of the population thinks the country's going in the wrong way, wrong direction. So what are your slogans? Hope and change. Yeah, of course. In fact, they were McCain's slogans, too. He didn't carry it off as well. And if you look at hope for what, you know, change for what, then it sort of drifts off into vacuity. You can't really say he disappointed people very much. I mean, yes, there was a little boilerplate here and there, but nothing much. There were institutions that strongly supported him, primarily the financial institutions. That was the core of his funding. They preferred him to McCain, and anybody who's paid attention to American politics over the last 150 years it would have predicted exactly what followed. They'd be paid off. Yeah, take a look at what's happening. Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, they're doing great. In fact, their big problem now is what to do to prevent people from being too furious at the huge bonuses they're paying. Yeah, sure, that's what happens when you get your candidate into office. The rest of the economy, it can tank. And it's the same on issue after issue. Like, take the thing about Egypt. Whoever it was who asked the question about how you find out what's going on, that was reported in the New York Times or somewhere, you know, in the mainstream press. It's just there was no reaction to it. I mean, it's there, you know, if you look, it's there. In fact, I learned years ago that if you want to read, say, the New York Times, and you're in a hurry, the best way to read it is to start from the end of the continuation page of a front page story, because the next, the last paragraph often has some pretty interesting stuff in it. My suspicion is that the journalists know that the first paragraph is for the editors and the headline writers, and down sort of to the end they can put in what they think or something. There was another great one in the Times just a couple of days ago, one of these laudatory articles about, front page article, about how we have to support Obama and the surge and so on. And then at the end of the continuation page, there was a paragraph, the only reference to the attitude of Afghans. And it said, well, throughout the South, you know, where the fighting is, Afghans don't like what we're doing and think we ought to stop. That, in a free newspaper, that'd be the headline. You know? But it's there. You read it carefully. And as I say, I don't know a thing about Obama as a person. Maybe he's a nice guy to have dinner with or whatever. But his policies are quite consistent, and they're pretty much the way Condoleezza Rice predicted. I don't agree with her about a lot of things, but she predicted that Obama was probably going to be pretty much like the second Bush term. And in fact, if you look at the two Bush terms, they were quite different. I mean, the first one, you know, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, those guys, was, you know, just off the spectrum. They antagonized and infuriated the entire world, including allies. U.S. prestige sank to the cellar. And they kind of got rid of all of them. They couldn't get rid of Cheney because that is the administration, but everybody else was kicked out. And it became considerably more, you know, what's called moderate, towards the center-right, you know, sort of the norm. And Obama's pretty much following it. A little few changes here and there, not a great deal. We have a pretty narrow spectrum of politics. There's a spectrum, there's a difference, but it's not enormous. And I think, just judging by what he says and what he does, I think you get a pretty clear picture of what he's got in his heart that's, know, for him and Michelle to talk about. I don't care.
First of all, I'd like to thank Nancy for her eyewitness account of what you saw in Gaza. Mm-hmm. I don't have a specific question, but I just wanted to express my appreciation so that at least we won't have the excuse of saying we didn't know. And I just have a very brief question. Professor Chomsky has already answered my second question about why we always come up with excuses not to boycott Israel and not to follow divestment. So you've already commented on that, and I appreciate it. Then one personal question. How do you appreciate being labeled as maybe the foremost leftist spokesperson as to, opposed to be a spokesperson who is for moral analysis and of our government's policies and just finding a way for a just way to deal with our adversaries as well as our friends?
Okay, I'm going to let you answer that part, but I just want to say one thing. Hooking on to what Professor Chomsky said a few minutes ago, in terms of the whole effort to make our government stop supplying weapons to Israel, there is something called the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, which has over 360 member groups. Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights is one of them, and they have been making this a campaign. Look at their website. It's www.endtheoccupation.org. So you can join it, and you can be really, you know, swelling the numbers of people who raise their voices about the issue of living by our own law and international law when it comes to supplying these aggressive weapons to Israel.
First of all, I don't consider it an insult to be labeled as part of the left. You know, yeah, that's where I am. But we should. But that's not the way the word is intended. It's intended as an insult. But you have to look at the way terms are used. Like, take a look at the debate over the health care bill. I mean, there are people who are called the left and the moderates and the rights. The left are like half a mile to the right of the general population. The moderates are like off the spectrum. You know, they're opposed by an overwhelming majority of the population. And the right are just trying to make sure everything fails. You know, what do the terms mean? Who are the moderate Democrats? Like, the moderate Democrats are opposed to the public option, right? They're the moderates. I mean, by 2-1, the population favors it. And for decades, a large majority of the population has called for a national health care system. Well, you know, that's considered politically lacking political support. Both parties and everyone else can't talk about that. I mean, Obama made it, U.S. drug prices are way higher than any other country. And one of the reasons, primary reason, is that it's the only country where the government is barred by law from negotiating drug prices using its purchase. It can do it for the VA, so prices are much lower there, but it's not allowed to use its purchasing power to lower drug prices. Well, there's no debate over this. In fact, Obama made a deal with the drug companies assuring them that he wasn't going to change this. Front page of the New York Times was not concealed. What does the population think? Well, about 85% are opposed, which means that the left, the moderates, and the right are all way to the right of the population. I mean, these terms, they don't even have any meaning, you know? Just like liberal and conservative have no meaning. So who cares what you're called?
You hear a lot in the U.S. news media about the importance of reaching a two-state solution. Now, regardless of whether the U.S. is sincere in that goal, do you think if Israel were to end all its settlements, allow West Bank and Gaza to unite and all of that, do you think then Israel should be allowed to have a two-state, would be acting correctly and should be allowed to have a two-state solution, a peaceful solution with Palestine?
I'm not sure I understand. Since about the mid-70s, there's been just an overwhelming international consensus, including about everyone except the United States and Israel, in favor of a two-state settlement. So yes, if Israel and the United States were willing to accept it, it could be implemented. And in fact, you know, it's now often discussed, it's worth bringing up, a common discussion, you know, a lot of the commentary now says it's impossible, it's already gone. I don't agree with that. Furthermore, I think it's a real note of despair, apart from not being true. If you look over the past 35 years, there has been one moment when a U.S. president was willing to tolerate, not support, but to tolerate the international consensus. That was Clinton's last month in office, January 2001. In the last month in office, he, just to remind you of what happened then, in the year 2000, they had the Camp David meetings. The sort of official story is, you know, the Palestinians wouldn't negotiate and so on. Everyone involved knew that wasn't true, including Clinton. He recognized that the U.S.-Israeli offers at Camp David couldn't be accepted by any Palestinian. And in December of 2000, this is right at the end of his term, he produced what he called his parameters for a solution. They were kind of vague, but, you know, more forthcoming than Camp David. He then gave a speech in which he said that both sides had accepted the parameters and both sides had reservations. They met in Taba, Egypt, both sides, in January, to iron out the reservations. And they came very close to a complete settlement. In their last press conference, they said that if they had a few more days, they might have reached a total agreement. Well, Israel called off the negotiations at that point, so it wasn't consummated. But it was very close. And, you know, a lot has happened since then, but not enough to change the basic facts. If an American president were willing to tolerate it, I think it could be implemented. Now, a common, what you read constantly, I'm sure you've seen this 1,000 times, that it not only is a two-state solution, that the alternatives are either a two-state solution, which is maybe over the bridge, or else Israel will become an apartheid state. And maybe, you know, the peace movement should support that, and then there could be an apartheid struggle in South Africa and so on. That's not going to happen. The United States and Israel are not going to permit that to happen, and they have an alternative, namely exactly what they are now implementing, the policy that I described, sometimes called convergence. We take what we want. We turn the rest into a region where the people can live like dogs, and there won't be any, we don't have any responsibility for them. So no apartheid struggle, no civil rights struggle, no demographic problem. In fact, it gets even worse. This time I could go into it, but you know, that's a strategy to which is being implemented, you know, not inventing it, and that's the alternative to a two-state settlement. Now, you also sometimes hear that things are so far gone that you can't get rid of the settlements. However, that's beside the point as well. You don't have to get rid of the settlements. All that Israel has to do is withdraw the army from the West Bank. As soon as they withdraw the army from the West Bank, 90% of the settlers will climb into the trucks provided to them and go from their subsidized homes in the West Bank to subsidized homes inside Israel. Nothing, you know. In fact, the withdrawal from Gaza was interesting in that respect. It was presented as a trauma. And so if you're reading the Boston Globe, you know, front page picture of a little boy pleading with the soldiers not to destroy his home, and, you know, tears, never again, and so on and so forth. It was all staged. It was a total farce. It was completely staged in order to be a national trauma. So you could then say, never again, we've got to keep everything in the West Bank. But it was staged. All they had to do was say that on August 1st, the IDF is leaving Gaza, and the 8,000 settlers there would have piled into the trucks and be driven to their new subsidized homes in the West Bank or the Golan Heights. And then there would have been no national trauma and no front page pictures in the Globe and no never again and anything else. And the fact that the world fell for this is pretty remarkable because it was a repeat, an almost point-by-point repeat of a farce in 1982. When Israel finally agreed to make peace, to withdraw from Egypt, they had to withdraw from the settlements in Egypt, the illegal settlements. So they staged a national trauma. In fact, there was a headline, and I remember a headline in the mainstream Israeli press saying, National Trauma 1982. Because it was such an obvious farce. You know, they had, and in fact, they pointed out, you know, here's this great protest, you have to drag the settlers out. They said not one settler was injured at a time when Palestinians were being killed all over the place. So, yeah, it was a staged trauma to set the situation so we don't have to go on. The same was true in Gaza, and the same would be true in the West Bank. Now, there is a footnote that has to be added. Israel has changed since 1982. And in fact, the changes were already being discussed then. One of the changes is that the military system is changing. It used to be back in the 70s and the 60s that the high officers, you know, the colonels, generals, and so on, were mostly coming from the kibbutz movement, from the left. There was a kind of like a trade-off with the kibbutz movement. The government would subsidize them and they'd provide the paratroopers and the elite forces and, you know, work their way up to the top. So all the famous people you've heard of, like, you know, came out of the kibbutz movement. But that started to change around the early 80s, and they started coming less from the kibbutzim and more from the national religious movement. And by now, a very large part of the higher level of the officer corps, you know, the colonels and so on, have come out of religious nationalist movements where the orders of the rabbis, who are pretty crazy, are more important than the state. So what you could have is a military coup. And that's not a joke. I mean, it's being seriously discussed by Israeli analysts. It could be that if there was an order to withdraw from the West Bank, the army, that large parts of the top military echelon would just reject the state's orders. Well, that's a military coup. Okay, at that point, the situation changes radically. I don't think the United States, much as Obama might want to, would be able to continue to support it. So yes, that would be, and then they would really go down the tube. You know, not just be a pariah state, but be a state abandoned by the one vote in the United Nations that counts. So those are options, but I think the most likely one is that if the United States was willing to tolerate a political settlement, it could be implemented. And the outlines are pretty well understood. Incidentally, I don't think it's an attractive settlement. In fact, I think it's an awful one. I always have ever since childhood. But I don't think it makes sense to take that region and draw a line through it. I mean, anyone who's ever traveled there or lived there knows that there is simply no way to draw a sensible line through mandatory Palestine. But a two-state settlement could be a step towards something much more sensible for everyone, some form of federalism or integration or so on once the cycle of violence reduces. And that's conceivable. It's not easy, but it's conceivable. I just happen to have come back from Ireland, Northern Ireland and the Republic. I was in Northern Ireland in 1993, and it was a war zone. I mean, watchtowers all over, you know, people afraid to move from one place to another. You couldn't park your car because the police would open up the trunk and stuff. Now it's peaceful on the surface. So you walk through Belfast and an outsider doesn't particularly notice anything. For one thing, because all the people sort of look alike. You know? But if you look carefully, you have a guide, and they show you the murals on the walls. You see that you do pass places which say, you know, loyalist, you're entering a loyalist area, don't enter here. And there's not very much in the way of integration or of the two sides, but the steps are there for it. I mean, it's a large, it's a tremendous advance, much better than it was, and it does set the stage for moving on to something better. And, you know, that's the way long, simmering conflicts have to be dealt with. This one can be, too. But the first, I don't know of any proposal, real proposal, that's even coherent, that doesn't begin with a two-state settlement, which I think is feasible. And I think the U.S., we're the main roadblock.
Thank you.
So we'll take one more question.
Actually, it's one question, but with two sections. First of all, what's regard?
Okay.
Regard to Palestinian 48 in Israel. You know, Israel passed the Nakba law that prevents Palestinians from commemorate the displacement of Palestinians out of their homeland. Okay. The Nakba law.
What is it?
It's Nakba law that prevent Palestinians from commemorate their displacement from their homeland, and Israel now talk about other laws, residency laws. Will this help and clarify the face of Israel as racist state? This one thing, and also you keep say that international borders, as if Israel want to build this separation wall or segregation wall, they can build it in the separation in the international borders. What are these international borders? Are these based on the partition plan 47 or 242, or what are these things? It looks like when we are talking about this that there is legitimate border for Israel that Israel itself do not.
So what are the borders and what happened in 48?
Yeah.
Well. What happened in 48 was...
Not 48, excuse me, it's not 48. Regard the policy regard to Palestinian in 48.
Yeah, I see. So what are the status of Arab citizens of Israel?
Yeah, because in the last military training, they now consider that maybe those Palestinians will have their own intifada, their own uprising, and they now would consider that the only threat for Israel is those Palestinians, not in Gaza, not in West Bank.
Yeah, I'm not hearing very well. Are you asking about the civil rights of Palestinians inside Israel?
He's asking about the law, the Nakba.
Actually, that law didn't pass. It was brought to the Knesset, but it didn't pass. Look, there's a racist... First of all, it's true that Palestinians are kind of second-class citizens in Israel in a lot of respects. The most important respect, which is rarely discussed, has to do with access to land. Up until the year 2000, just to be clear, the resolution you're talking about was defeated in the Knesset. It was brought up, but it was defeated. But
pardon? It's passed. I have a copy. It's passed. This law passed.
Has been passed?
Yeah.
This a law passed. Blocking discussion of the Nakba?
The law preventing Palestinians from commemorating.
From commemorating, yeah, but not discussing it. They can do that. Yeah, that's true. But, you know, suppose you tried to have a celebration here, commemorating the genocide of the indigenous population. It wouldn't be treated very nicely in Boston. Okay, maybe you could have it, maybe not. Well, except that we don't talk about it that way. If somebody did talk about it that way, it'd be quite different. In fact, you know, until very recently, you could barely even discuss these things. I mean, so, take, say, the most elevated parts of American intellectual life, say, the New York Review of Books, peak of liberal intellectual life. 3 or 4 months ago, they had an article by a well-known left liberal journalist, Russell Baker, saying that he was reviewing a book by an eminent historian, and he said that what he learned from the book, he was very excited to learn from the book, that when Columbus landed in the Western, in the hemisphere, there were only about 1 million people, hunter-gatherers straggling around and so on. Well, you know, that's kind of like off by maybe 80 million or so. They weren't hunter-gatherers, but they had advanced civilizations, at least as advanced as the Europeans and so on. You know, that's genocide denial, kind of like with a vengeance. There wasn't a single letter responding to it. Okay. If you go back 30 or 40 years, it's much worse. I mean, like you go back to Theodore Roosevelt, he was applauding the genocide of the indigenous population. Yeah, it's unfortunate, but these things are true. Israel is not immune to it, but it doesn't come close to our own history. Nevertheless, and that's not the serious restriction on civil rights, by no means. The most serious one is the one I started to talk about, the access to land. Up until the year 2000, there's an array of Israeli laws, actually I wrote about them about 30 years ago, if you want the details. They're kind of all quite intricate system of laws, which in effect exclude Israeli Arab citizens from 92% of the land. Okay, that's pretty serious. I mean, if there's a law in the United States excluding, say, Jews from 90% of the country, people would be upset. In the year 2000, the civil rights group movement in Israel, ACRI, managed to push a case up to the High Court, Supreme Court, in a particular town, Katzir, in which an Arab couple wanted to move in. And the town had blocked it because it's on land from which Arabs are barred. And it went to the courts, and the courts finally decided that they couldn't block them. Okay, then another 6 years went by before they got in. And as far as I know, that's the only case of breaking this barrier. We're not unfamiliar with that here. Actually, I've experienced it myself. Like, there's no laws in the United States barring Jews from settling in the suburbs of Boston. But when my wife and I were looking for a house back in the early 60s, kids growing up couldn't pay the rents in Cambridge, wanted to move into the suburbs, and we asked, we looked around various towns. One of them was Winchester, which looked kind of nice. So we asked the agent, is there anything for sale there? And he looked at it, he said, you wouldn't be happy there, meaning no Jews. When I was a kid, and my father, say in the late 30s, was able to buy a secondhand car, and we'd drive out into the suburbs, maybe try to spend the weekend in the hills, you had to be careful. If a motel said restricted on it, that meant no Jews. Okay, that was the 1930s. That's Jews. You know, it's still the case with, you know, much harsher for blacks, of course. So yeah, it's all around. And in fact, it's around in Israel too. And it's very serious. And yeah, these are problems that ought to be dealt with in every country. I mean, we have no high horse in this respect. I mean, I won't run through the history of African Americans in the United States, but it's been slavery from the beginning, almost up till today, except now we call it incarceration, with very few breaks. So yeah, there's a lot of internal problems that we and other countries have to face. Israel's one of them. But was that the whole question?
The international borders of Israel.
What? The international border. Well, you know, I mean, there isn't an international border in the world that has any justice behind it. I mean, say, take the U.S. and Mexico. I mean, the U.S. is sitting on half of Mexico, which was conquered in a brutal, aggressive war in 1846-48. Is there anything just about it? No. In fact, we have a wall to prevent Mexicans from going to cities with names like Los Angeles and San Diego, you know, Spanish names, from the conquered territories. Is it just? No, not by any abstract standards. But in fact, the entire existence of states isn't just. They're all imposed by violence. But I think the borders ought to be reduced and, in fact, erased, as is to some extent happening in the European Union. And I think it would be a great thing in the Levant, you know, Eastern Mediterranean, if they would go back to something like the Ottoman Empire. Now, nobody wants the brutality and the corruption of the Ottoman Empire, but they had the right idea, I think. There were no borders. So if you wanted to go from Cairo to Istanbul to Baghdad, you didn't pass a border. If you were in a particular town, let's say Beirut or something, you know, the Greeks would run the Greek affairs and the Armenians would run the Armenian affairs. And it was kind of it's a sensible way for societies to be organized. The state system was imposed largely by European violence. Within Europe itself, it took centuries to impose the state system. That's why Europe was the most savage place in the world for centuries, slaughtering each other, to try to impose state systems on societies that were just very varied and complex and many languages and so on and didn't have any unity. It was imposed by force. And if you look around the world today, almost all the horrible conflicts going on in the world, including Israel-Palestine, are places where Europe tried to impose a state system. And it's a very unnatural system. It has no absolute justification for it. But you either accept it as a basis for moving on, or you're kind of you're living on Neptune. I mean, we can't ignore it as a basis for moving on. We can say we don't like it, so we don't think there ought to be a wall barring Mexicans from going to the territory that we stole from them. But that's the kind of thing you have to deal with internal to the United States, to say, well, you know, how do we deal with that defect in our own history, serious defect?